This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. In 1995, Barbara Leigh Toffler signed on with Arthur Andersen Accounting as a partner in charge of their ethics consulting group. It was her job to advise Andersen clients on responsible business practices. But soon after arriving at the firm, Toffler, a former faculty member of the Harvard Business School and the author of a book on business ethics, began to notice troubling ethical behavior within the company itself. Her new book, Final Accounting, Ambition, Greed, and the Fall of Arthur Andersen, is her analysis of the flawed corporate culture, business strategies, and fractured leadership that led to Andersen's being implicated in the Enron scandal 2 years ago. Arthur Andersen was the auditing firm for Enron. It was found guilty of obstruction of justice for shredding documents related to the Securities and Exchange Commission's inquiry into the corporation. In her book, Toffler writes that Andersen's indoctrination of young employees created a culture of conformity, which was more extreme than in most accounting firms. Andersen sent new hires to a training facility in St. Charles, Illinois, which Toffler likens to a boot camp.
Every young person who was brought into the firm had an accounting degree and was recruited right out of their undergraduate education. They were 21, 22 years old, and they were then brought in, sent to this St. Charles facility, and basically, transformed into what they called androids. The process by which they learned to do the kind of audits, to follow the kind of accounting procedures that a public accountant does, was one that was carefully worked out so that each year of approximately 7 or 8 years, they acquired new skills, they performed new activities, and they learned to behave in a certain way. They learned to dress in a certain way. They learned to eat lunch in a certain way. They learned a variety of particular activities so that you recognized worldwide an Arthur Andersen person.
It sounds as if the young recruits, at least at Arthur Andersen, were taught to follow the rules and also follow the leader, follow their leaders. What were they taught about business ethics?
I don't think that they were taught anything that really translated into what ethical behavior should mean. One of the things that, at least in the time, by the time I came there, I found the most unsettling was that I had no sense that any young person was taught that the primary stakeholder they served was the investing public. That was something that did not seem to be part of their ethical training. My experience led me to believe that the primary stakeholder they learned, the young people learned to attend to, was, in fact, the partner who could control their future career.
Now, conformity works as long as the leadership is ethical and decent and has a certain amount of integrity. But you write that when the game and the leaders changed direction, the culture of conformity led to disaster. You write about the practice of boosting revenues, which was a company-wide practice of overcharging. In fact, it was referred to as billing your brains out. So what were some of the techniques that Andersen used to inflate client fees?
Well, of course, our hourly rates were enormously high. Partners were billed out anywhere from maybe $350 an hour when they started to about $500 an hour. And we found problems within the firm. I actually talk about something that was known as the planned fee adjustment, which was sort of the hook to pull in clients. And this was a plan by which you would offer for a first job a substantial discount. We want your business. You're a good client. I think we refer to it as something similar to what used car salesmen do. And it was very, very, very similar. And then on that first job, though you've already set such a high fee by exploding the number of hours that you are going to be working, you then say, but we are going to give you this wonderful discount. Part of the practice then would be, while delivering the service that you had signed on to deliver, was indeed to find a variety of other problems. And when those are presented, as you're walking out the door and the client says, oh, but we need you, you say, well, yes, of course, but our regular fees are such and such. And that, of course, then allowed you to come, well, perhaps stay in rather than even come back in with these higher fees and hopefully a carte blanche to be able to expand the services and deliver them as richly as you could. There was the other side of the problem, of course, which if the client said, look, this is the amount of money we're spending, and that's it, we're capping it at this, then, of course, there was the question as to whether or not you really got very good service.
On the surface of it, again, none of this is overtly illegal, certainly, or even unethical. I mean, someone might say, well, why the marketplace put up with it? A client can always go elsewhere. Is that how people within Anderson, I guess, rationalize this kind of billing your brains out behavior to themselves?
Well, I think there was certainly the belief that kind of we're worth it. We're Arthur Anderson. We're the best. Certainly, some of these things are practices across professional service firms, other accounting firms, and I dare say some law firms as well. So what we are talking about is not necessarily something that is illegal. That is what is so insidious about this. You know, if they had been doing things that were illegal, that were egregiously unethical, that you, I, and everyone else could say, that's outright unethical, they wouldn't have gotten away with it. The fact was that this all came within the way we do business. This became certainly as in the last years of the firm with the new economy and the dot-coms, this became the way we do business around here, long forgotten the way they used to do business. But that's what's so important about this story, is the fact that these were standard activities that just kept moving further and further, whether you call it down the slippery slope or outside the acceptable way of doing business. But they were not egregiously unethical, not illegal. And that's why it took so long and I guess became so very, very dysfunctional before it destroyed the firm.
Now, one of the key charges in the Enron fiasco is that Anderson had a conflict of interest in that they were both an auditing firm for Enron, and they were also hired on as financial consultants. So they had a vested interest in maintaining this illusion that Enron was in good financial order. How common is this among accounting firms to serve both as financial consultants and as auditors?
In the last 10, 12 15 years, it has become more and more common. In fact, I believe all of the big six at the time, developed consulting services, among them the outsourcing of internal audit, which for many people, and I would include myself in this, became the ultimate of conflict of interest. In this case, you have one firm, Arthur Anderson, doing both the internal auditing for a firm and the external auditing. It's a conflict. That's all there is. One side is doing the work and the other side is essentially assessing whether or not the work is done properly, and they're all the same group.
So you would think that the checks and balances you would need in order to avoid a conflict of interest, it sounds as if they just simply weren't there, weren't even thought of, or not. There wasn't even a nod to it.
That's exactly right. And it was a blindness, I think. And again, a blindness driven by the desire for revenues. That became the driving force. And the mantra in the firm became keep the client happy, because by keeping the client happy is how, in fact, you bring in more revenues. Keeping the client happy, of course, had disastrous outcomes because it meant you don't want to tell a client anything that may upset them. Just to go back briefly to the original Arthur Anderson, early on in his career, he stood up to a very major client, basically said, I am not going to change these numbers to make you happy, and you want to take your business and walk, you can take your business and walk, which the client did, but it established who that firm, Arthur Anderson, was going to be. By the time I came in, there were there was not this sense of if the client doesn't adhere to the way we want to do it, then we will have to lose the client. The point was, what does the client want? Let's give it to them.
I'm talking with Barbara Leigh Toffler. She was a partner in charge of ethics and responsible business practices consulting services for Arthur Andersen Accounting Firm from 1995 to 1999. She's co-written a book about her experience at Andersen. It's called Final Accounting: Ambition, Greed, and the Fall of Arthur Andersen. Barbara Leigh Toffler now teaches at Columbia University Business School. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barbara Leigh Toffler. She was the partner in charge of the accounting firm Arthur Andersen's ethics consulting group in the late 90s. She left before Andersen was implicated in the Enron debacle. She has a new book about her understanding of the business practices that led to Andersen's demise. It's called Final Accounting. What did these problematic business practices and corporate clashes amount to in the late 90s for Arthur Andersen?
In the late 90s, we began to see the first of a series of client disasters. Probably the first most prominent one was Waste Management, which was followed then by Sunbeam and the Arizona Baptist Foundation, and then subsequently, of course, Enron, WorldCom, several others. But what was coming out, and it wasn't just Arthur Andersen, remember. There were a number of these, none quite as dramatic, I think, as Waste Management and Sunbeam, that led to a couple of things. One, in 1998, Business Week had an article that was headlined, "Where Were the Accountants?" which enumerated the many accounting failures that were starting to emerge. And then in September of 1998, Arthur Levitt, then head of the SEC, of course, raised then the big concern about managing earnings and basically put the accounting firms on notice that something was awry and he and his team were going to do everything they could to look into it and correct whatever was going on. So that is what started to happen in the late 90s. Now, something else that was happening at Arthur Andersen, too, at the time, was that it was becoming very intrigued by the new economy. As we say, we believe Arthur Andersen jumped into the arms of the new economy like a teenager with raging hormones. I'm not sure we say it just like that. But basically, that was the case. So that while there were concerns on the part of the oversight committees, there was also this wild abandon on the part of Arthur Andersen and several of the other firms as well.
Now, at this point, and this is around 1998 or so,
right,
late 90s, before Enron, at this point, did Andersen take any action to clean up its accounting?
1998 should have provided Arthur Andersen the opportunity to both clean up its business and to be a leader in reshaping the accounting firm. And I fault them, perhaps most of all, for not taking advantage of the extraordinary capability that they had at that point to have made a phenomenal difference. In 1998, I was invited to attend two meetings of an existing committee called the Risk Management Executive Committee. This committee was made up of top partners in the firm. It was made up of people from the Professional Standards Group. It was made up of attorneys and leading partners nationally. At these two committee meetings, discussion took place at which it was clear that the Arthur Andersen leadership was absolutely aware of the many kinds of problems, both internally and externally, that the firm and the profession were facing. In point of fact, they laid out a document, which we were all asked to comment on, that enumerated the internal risks, the external risks, and even went so far as to stating in one place that there should be real concern of the impact of aggressive accounting when the economy tanks. Now, if you know this in 1998 and disasters that occurred in 2000 were still allowed to occur, I feel that that was the greatest tragedy that we saw at Arthur Andersen.
They had this risk management committee and this kind of landmark meeting. What came of it?
As far as I know, almost nothing. There was a single document that, in point of fact, my group was asked to design to make it one of the pieces of material going out that would grab everyone's attention, that came to be known as the Cooking the Books memo. This went out in, I believe, October of 1998, that basically said, our clients are at risk. We are at risk. There's cooking the books going on. We've got to pay attention. We can all suffer great harm. And it went out. What happened? I don't know. I don't think there was any major effort that was taken. I never heard anyone stand up and say, we have just gone through waste management. We have just gone through Sunbeam. This is a sin, a shame. That a firm like Arthur Andersen should be engaged in this is horrifying. We are going to change, and we're going to lead the way to change others. That's what should have been done, and it was never done. The words that I heard about waste management is, we didn't do anything wrong, we've paid, and we've put that all behind us, and we're going forward.
They paid settlement fees.
Yes, they paid settlement fees. No indication, as they would say, that they had done anything wrong.
You resigned in 1999. What was the final straw for you that prompted your leaving the company?
There were several, certainly, final straws. I went through a series of events, and certainly at the time of the Global Risk Management Committee presentation, I had high hopes that maybe this was really going to finally turn around and the firm was going to start to pay some attention to its own concerns and to, we hoped, the ethics group as well. But I think for me, the fact that there was no follow-up to that and that ultimately I signed on to a project in which I egregiously inflated my proposal. This was a large project for an international bank that was merging. That I inflated my proposal was part of an uncomfortable presentation to a client who should have been a wonderful client. And I suddenly became so terribly embarrassed about what I had done and about the proposal that we were presenting that I actually called up the client. No one will know until they read the book. I don't think anyone knew at the time. Said, we're ripping you off. Hung up the phone and said, that's it. I really cannot stay in this firm any longer.
What do you see as the moral of this Enron Arthur Andersen story? What lessons does it teach about reforms that are needed in the accounting industry?
Probably the most important lesson is that there must be a greater awareness of conflicts of interest, of the broad range of conflicts of interest. There must be greater recognition that accounting firms are there to serve the public, that they are there to clarify and assure that numbers are accurate, and that we, at least for the near future, need some very strenuous regulation and oversight. There are some perhaps lesser issues. Our public accounting firms are partnerships. I think that structure probably has to be looked into because it is a structure that allows the diffusion of responsibility and does not allow independence in the leadership who are completely subject to the whim and will of the partners. But that is probably secondary right now to the kind of very strong oversight that is going to be essential. And the firms asked for it, unfortunately, and I think or hope that they're going to get it.
Barbara Leitoffler, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Barbara, thank you for having me. I was delighted to be here.
Barbara Leitoffler's new book is Final Accounting, Ambition, Greed, and the Fall of Arthur Andersen. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.